Okay, so welcome to this lecture series. Tonight is our first night. It's a 10-week lecture series, and the title of it is Compassionate Understanding. And I'm hoping tonight will serve as an introduction to what counselling is all about and what compassionate understanding and this concept that we've come up with is all about. But before I do that, I just want to run you through how the next few weeks will look like, and then we'll get into today's details. So tonight we're going to talk about Christianity and counselling, and specifically what a Christian counsellor is and how we can acquire skills, or the skills that we need to have, or the characteristics that we need to have to counsel others, or to walk with others in times of pain or problems that they may come to us with. So that's tonight. Next week is a big topic. Next week we're going to talk about empathy. And we're actually going to start to talk about problem solving and how we go through the problem solving process using empathy. Then the following week we're going to talk about emotions and an emotional approach to problem solving and addressing issues. The week after that we're going to talk about cognition, the mind, and how we think, and how we can use a cognitive, so the way we think, and a behavioural, the way we behave, approach to helping people around us sort through issues they might be facing. Then we're going to go into more specific things like addictions, personality, parenting issues, abuse, and the detection and the treatment of people who have suffered abuse in their life. So that gives you an overview of the 10 weeks. We'll take a break for Passion Week, but other than that, we'll hopefully get through the 10 weeks sequentially without any problems. How tonight will work is we'll go till 9:30. We'll have a break at about 8:30 till say quarter to nine, and then we'll come back and we'll finish off at 9:30. Does anyone have any pressing questions or any issues that they have before we start? Okay, so not yet. Okay, we'll try to have at least 10 to 15 minutes of question time at the end, but if at any stage you feel like you have a question or a comment that you'd like to add, please feel free to jump in. This isn't a formal process by any means. Before we start, Dasoni asked me just to highlight something to you guys, and I think it's important that we're aware of this. There is a major difference between a counsellor, a psychologist, and a psychiatrist. And just to make things quite clear for everyone about where I come from, I'm a counsellor, and it's only yesterday that I was looking at some notes from college and I discovered that I've been a counsellor for over 6-7 years now, and I thought it was only 2, but, you know, time flies. And a counsellor primarily deals with a person on a one-to-one basis. They're on equal par with the person that they deal with, neither above nor below the person that they see. And a counsellor's main aim is to facilitate change and to be an agent of change in a person's life. Whereas a psychologist is a person who is more concerned with how the mind works and how different parts of the brain all function. They might use the same techniques and the same methods as some counsellors do, but they're far more concerned about the mind and the physiological workings of the mind and how it works. And going from there, a psychiatrist is obviously a doctor who's done postgraduate work, and they are then people who tend to prescribe medication or have a more medical approach to issues at hand. Generally, people with things like schizophrenia, personality disorders, all those sorts of things, would tend to see a psychologist and probably a psychiatrist at some stage, whereas people with life issues would tend to come and see a counsellor. So we tend to be a bit more busy than most would think. So that's just a brief summary of the differences between a counsellor, a psychologist and a psychiatrist, just so that you know where I come from. And I guess I want to start tonight by making it really clear about the links and the relationship between Christianity and counselling and what it means to be a Christian counsellor. A lot of the times I get asked when I speak about different techniques or different things that we may do to help a person through an issue is, where is this in the Bible? Where does this come from? How is this based? Is it a Christian basis, or is it a worldly basis? Is it an atheist person that came up with these ideas, or where did all these things come from? And I think before we get into the theories of counselling and analyse them and start to look at, you know, what aspects of these can be applied in a Christian perspective and what can't, I think it's far more important for us to look at what a counsellor needs to look like and to compare that with what a Christian needs to look like. And from there, we'll be able to see that the two that a counsellor and a Christian are very much one and the same, and that, you know, our biggest example in counselling is Christ himself, you know, because he was called counsellor in the Bible. So, not to dwell on that too much, but the focus of tonight is really to understand what compassionate understanding is all about. That key fundamental characteristic that any counsellor, any person wanting to walk with another through a problem needs to have. And to be a person who can effectively listen to another's soul is to be able to have compassionate understanding for another's, for another, requires one to look within themselves first. I need to look within myself. I need to see what are the things that I can offer and what are my shortcomings before I can delve into the issues of another person. Having said that, I'm not here to profess to you that I have all these characteristics. It's more that in the moment in time where I am with a person going through an issue, or they are sharing their soul with me, speaking to me about things that are private and deep and often painful in their life, I need to ensure that I can acquire as many of these characteristics as possible during that time. And the first one is compassionate understanding. And, you know, to show someone compassionate understanding is to show them the love of Christ. It's to show them mercy without showing them judgment. To be graceful to them without pointing a finger and saying, well, this is what's wrong with you and this is what needs to be fixed. And if we look at the word compassion, it literally means suffer with another, a sensation of sorrow, excited by the distress or misfortunes of another. So it actually means to have compassion is to be able to put myself into another person's shoes and be able to imagine and feel how they would feel in their time of sorrow or pain. And because of that, compassionate understanding is then the foundation of all Christian counselling. I can't be an effective Christian counsellor if I don't have compassion and understanding for others. And it's an approach that to counselling that's both technical and biblical. You know, it's technical in that I must have empathy for my clients, I must have understanding for my clients, and it's biblical, as we'll talk through these examples, I'll hopefully be able to prove to you. And also, the other thing to know about compassionate understanding is to have compassionate understanding is not to pity a person. So when someone comes into my office and sits down and talks to me about an abuse that they suffered as a child, they don't need me to sit there and say, oh, you poor thing, I feel so sorry for you, that's so horrible, you know, that I wish that never happened. They don't actually need pity. What they need is, what they're coming to say to me is, this is a horrible thing that's happened in my life. I want to know how to overcome it. I want to be able to live my life not linked to this event, not being controlled by that situation that happened in my life. And so to have compassionate understanding is not to feel sorry for someone, but to be able to see the strengths that they have, even in the most horrendous of times. You know, and that leads me to this story. When I was preparing for this, the one image that kept coming into my mind when I thought of compassionate understanding is the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman at that well. And I thought, you know, the pictures, every image that I looked at on Google or in the church or whatever, she's dressed so nicely and she's so decent and, you know, she's got an attractive face and she looks clean and, you know, it doesn't even go with the story. It doesn't make sense. And I thought about it and I thought, I don't actually agree with this picture. You know, I think that her figure, her posture, her clothes, her appearance, her hair, what she wore, were all a reflection of her life. And I think it was a life of abuse, adultery, men, and probably intense pain. And pain that I think that was obvious to him. You know, it was obvious to him because he had a compassionate understanding for her. Whereas everyone else saw her as, you know, an adulteress and an evil woman that should be, you know, shunned and spat at and sworn at and called names. He saw something different. He saw a pain that was so deep inside of her that most people overlooked. Most people looked at just the physical and looked at what they saw was right and wrong. And so I think about that day and I think, you know, as she walked through those streets in the middle of the day, in the heat, in the sun, and sweating and uncomfortable and just wanting to hide, the last thing she would have wanted was to be called a slut by someone, or to be, you know, to be labelled something by someone, to be thrown a stone at, to be spat at. The last thing she would have wanted was that. So I imagine her hunched over and quite protective of herself. So I think the last thing she expected, I think she was really taken aback when a man that wasn't even meant to speak to her, starts to approach her with gentleness. And he engages her in a conversation through the only thing that she could offer. He couldn't ask her about anything else. The only thing she could offer to him was water, and that's the only thing that he spoke to her about. He didn't talk to her about her sins. He didn't talk to her about what a horrible person she was. He spoke to her about her strength, the only thing that she could offer him. And I think that took her aback. I think that surprised her. And I think, too, that his gentleness and his non-judgmental approach compelled her to give him what he asked of her. If he was any other man, I think she would have probably tried to hide or run away or not engage in that conversation, because she would have probably suspected that she would know where it would end up. He'd either want something from her or he'd want to insult her further, and she could sense his genuineness. And so even when he confronted her with the truth of her life, he did it in a non-judgmental way. He praised the only thing he could about her. She was honest. And he said to her, you're honest. And and he praised her honesty. Here is a person who is full of wrongs, as the world may see her, but he didn't look at all of that. He didn't address all of that. He said to her, I see a quality in you. I see honesty in you. And at the same time, though, he didn't give her a pep talk about how wonderful she is. He didn't say, wow, you're such an amazing person. You're fantastic. You know, you are queen. You are marvelous. He didn't do any of that, because they both knew that that wasn't the case. They both knew that she wasn't this wonderful person that would have been worthy of such talk. But he also didn't help her feel good about the wrongs that she did. He didn't justify them, but he didn't emphasize them. He didn't say to her, it's okay that you've done these things, or, you know, or I approve of them, but he didn't emphasize them at the same time. She was aware enough of them. But what he did in having compassionate understanding for her is he empowered her to change. He empowered her to be able to say, this is what I've done, this is what's wrong with me, and now I feel like someone has seen some goodness in me, and by his strength I'm able to then change my life to an extent where she's no longer hunched over and hiding and covering her face. She's going out in the street saying, hey, I met someone and he told me everything about me. And that got people's attention, because it wasn't what they would have expected from someone who's always hunched over and afraid and not wanting anyone to speak to them. So compassionate understanding is the foundation of any counselling relationship. If he didn't have compassionate understanding for her, then she wouldn't have felt that comfort. She wouldn't have felt that peace that she felt after she left him. So that's the first thing, compassionate understanding, and it overrides pretty much everything else that we'll talk about tonight. Does anyone have any questions on that first point? Your notes are broken up in ways, so for those of you who like to write notes, you can write notes in them, and for those of you who just want to read along, you can. But does anyone have any questions on compassionate understanding before we go on to the next quality? Okay. So the next thing I want to talk to you about is something that a man by the name of Carl Rogers came up with. Now, I think it's important that we know a little bit about Carl Rogers. We'll see a video of him a bit later on, but Carl Rogers was born in 1902 and died in 1987. So he's fairly recent. He's not, you know, he's not from Freud's era. And his mother was a devout Christian. And up until the age of about 20, he was in training to be in the seminary, in training to be a priest, and he was quite content with that. And at some stage, he was disheartened by the church and disheartened by his faith, and he left it all. But that Christianity and that faith of his mother left a permanent mark on his life. And I think when you see him and you see his approach in counselling, you will see that he has a gentleness and a meekness that's quite different to a lot of other psychologists who held his position. But he came up with quite a few interesting things. And one of the first things he came up with, he said that in order for a healthy relationship to exist between a psychologist and a client, or a counsellor and a client, is something called unconditional positive regard. And unconditional positive regard means that no matter what I hear from the person I'm speaking to, I don't see them any less than. I don't see that as a characteristic of them. I don't see that as something that tarnishes them or changes their their quality or changes their value in God's eyes. And there's a quote that you've got in your notes that's really interesting, and it says, people's secrets, the secrets of their lives, and more especially the secrets of their souls, are precious. An unconditional positive regard has that as its foundation. Now, when someone comes and speaks to you about a secret of their soul, a secret of their life, that is something precious, rather than it being seen as something to be judged or to be analyzed, it's actually to be seen as a gift that the person is giving you. Because by giving you that gift of a secret of their life, they're actually disimparting, they're giving you some power and some authority over their life. They're giving you some trust that they probably wouldn't give to anyone else. So unconditional positive regard is when one person is completely accepting towards another person. So this isn't just a show of acceptance as like, yes, I like you the way you are, but it's an attitude. It's an attitude that then translates into behavior and translates into how I deal with my client or how I deal with the person that I'm helping on a day-to-day basis. And although Carl Rogers is a person who the world of psychology attributes the concept of unconditional positive regards to, it originates with Christ. And he was the true founder of a person-centered approach, which is what Carl Rogers talks about and the theory that he came up with. His theory is that my focus, the most important thing in a counseling relationship is the person that I'm dealing with, and it needs to be about them and not about me. But that's such a Christian way of thinking that I don't think he truly owns that, and I don't think that just came from his own mind. I think and I believe that it came from his upbringing and from him experiencing Christianity in that way. Carl Rogers believed that a person who grew up receiving unconditional positive regard from another became a healthy person, a complete person, a person who was then able to overcome challenges in their life. But he also believed that a person who grew up receiving only conditional positive regard, so when he was praised or affirmed only when he did certain things, then he became a person that was continuously trying to get approval from others, continuously trying to do more in order to feel like he's worthy of living. And obviously it's different degrees depending on how much or how little conditional or unconditional positive regard a person gets. And that's a powerful tool in the hands of Sunday school servants, in the hands of Christians, because if we know this, if we can convey to young people that there is an unconditional positive regard for them, that no matter what you say, no matter what you do, there's this unconditional love for you. And maybe it's not from us. Maybe we can direct them to God and say, look, God has this unconditional love for you. Maybe we can't display it all the time. Then that on its own is an empowering thing that we can do. Because later in their life, if they have that as a memory, if they have that as something that's happened in a young stage of their life, then they'll be courageous enough to face whatever comes their way. The power of unconditional positive regard and a non-judgmental attitude are so great that they alone are usually a catalyst for change. A counsellor who knows no technical skills, who knows very little about psychological theories, but has unconditional positive regard and a non-judgmental persona is usually able to help a person far greater than a psychologist with all the theory and all the knowledge in the world but is sitting on a pedestal telling them what they think they should do. It is a far more powerful tool in the hands of people who serve, because if we serve people, then at one level they feel like we're equal to them, even, dare I say, we're less than them. So if we can convey that unconditional positive regard and not appear to them that we know better than they, then we have a much more powerful influence in their life. And I think the biggest case in history to prove the power of unconditional positive regard took place over 2,000 years ago. And I'm going to keep referring to Christ, and I'm going to keep giving examples that he did, because he is and he continues to be the greatest counsellor. But I want you to try to imagine this. You know, there's a crowded street. He's there. He's preaching. There's people all around him. And these men are dragging this woman by her hair to him, parting the way, getting people to move either side, you know, and in the meantime, she may get a few kicks, a few punches, a few spits, a few stones. as they drag her to his feet. And that's where she lands. And they, you know, and in the midst of men who want nothing more than to kill her, and who come to him and say, you know what, the law says we stone her. What do you say? Come on. To test him, he stands there, and even though he has full authority to judge her, he doesn't. What's more, he actually forces those around her to not judge her. He gives a very powerful statement about, hey, look at yourselves first. And he says, you know, those of you without sin cast the first stone. And no one can do it, because people around him know that he knows. And by not judging her, and even though he was the only person that could judge her, he empowered her. He helped her believe that she could overcome her faults. He showed her her value as a human being. He restored her humanity to her and gave her a hope and life that she truly lost. I mean, if you're being kicked and spat on and dragged through the streets, what hope do you have of overcoming what you've done? It's not like people are not going to know. Everyone knows. But he restored her humanity by not judging her. He did say to her, go away and sin no more. And maybe people can question whether that was judgmental or not. But I think by that stage, that relationship was so strong and she so trusted in him that he had her affection and her trust to a point that he could say that without hurting her. He could say that as an empowering statement, as a statement that says to her, I believe that you have the strength to do this. I will give you the strength to do this. So by having an unconditional positive regard for others, it empowers them to change. And then it gives access to private and life-changing details of their life. By having that unconditional positive regard for someone, they will then feel comfortable. They know that what I can say in a counselling room, no one else is going to hear. I'm not going to be judged on. So when a young man walks into my office and sits down, and he knows why he's coming, and I know why he's coming, but there's that hesitation about what he wants to talk about. And so he beats around the bush and he tells me about, you know, his friendships and his university studies. And he tries very hard to avoid the core reason while he's there. It's not until that moment that he believes that I will not judge him, regardless of what he says to me. It's when that moment when he sees that for the hour that I'm with him, I see myself as a sinner like he, and we're equal, that he can then start to talk about his homosexuality. That he can start to talk about things that other people might be repulsed at and might shrink at and might frown upon, but he suddenly feels safe. He suddenly feels like, I can take a risk. I can say something, I can disclose something that I didn't think I can. And the main reason that happens is unconditional positive regard. It's because he gets to a point in the relationship where he knows, he believes that no matter what he says, it's not going to affect the way I see him. So as for people who want to help others, it's so important, it's so key that we learn to have the skill of unconditional positive regard. And it's a hard skill to acquire, because a lot of the times when someone is coming to us for help, we automatically turn our brain on and we automatically go into problem-solving mode, especially the men in the room, right? It's such a natural tendency to say, okay, well, this is the problem and this is how you fix it and this is what I think you should do. But the problem is when someone is coming to you with a pain that's that deep and a pain that's been there possibly for such a long time, they already know what you think they should do. But what's more, the minute you say, this is what I think you should do, you've instantaneously put yourself above them. And they know that. And they look at you and they think, okay, well, he's another Sunday school servant that's going to tell me what to do. He's another person that's going to throw my sins in my face. But the minute they start to sense that that's not the case, the minute they start to sense that this person actually has this unconditional positive regard towards me, regardless of what I say, regardless of what I tell them, what horrendous things I tell them that I've done, then they can trust you a bit more. Then they can start to say, well, I think I might be able to do this. And your role is just to affirm or not affirm, whatever the case may be, and we'll talk about what we do at that stage in the coming weeks. But they then have that trust. They then have that ability to think a bit deeper about the issues at hand. They then have that ability to start to analyze their own problems, and they feel like, oh, maybe I can overcome this. Maybe with the grace of God I can get through this. Maybe God doesn't hate me as much as I think he does, because this person doesn't hate me that much. And one of the things to know when we counsel someone, when we walk with someone through an issue, we, in a lot of people's minds, become, especially if we label ourselves as Christian counselors, become what God says to them, even though that's not the role we want to take. But if this human being, if this person, this creation of God, who I've come to talk about my problems to, can have this unconditional positive regard, this unconditional love for me, even if it's just for an hour, then maybe God can. And it has the power to start to change the way people relate to God and the way people have a spiritual connection with God. So that is unconditional positive regard. You have a question?
And you're in a position that...
I hear what you're saying, and I think what you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that in a position of authority where I have responsibilities to discipline and to teach, it's very, very difficult for me to convey that unconditional positive regard when my role is to discipline, when my role is to put boundaries and rules and limits. And I hear you, I agree with you, but unconditional positive regard doesn't require us to condone a behavior. What unconditional positive regard is as a person, I see you and I care about you and I have a positive regard of you, towards you, regardless of what you do. That does not mean to say that I agree with homosexuality or that I agree with your behavior. So it's a very fine line, and it is a balancing act, and it is something that comes with time. But it's about being able to have a relationship with that child in the playground and being able to, for that child to see that, you know, Miss can still come and say hello to me and smile and treat me like a normal person, even though she's disciplined me. And that action on its own gets the person thinking, oh, maybe it's that she doesn't hate me. And children often think in extremes, you know, she's punishing me or she's disciplining me, therefore she hates me. And they'll start to think, well, maybe she doesn't actually hate me, maybe she likes me, but maybe there's something wrong with what I've done. So it's actually quite empowering when I can start to find opportunities in such a role to convey that unconditional positive regard. So yes, discipline, yes, be firm, yes, put boundaries in place where they need to be, but at least try, whenever possible, to be out there and to be conveying to that child that I still care about you, I still love you, I still see you as a person who is able to achieve their potential and who can succeed irrespective of what you've done, because I know that that does not define you. And I hear what you're saying, in that can be difficult. And I guess I'm trying to say is, yeah, it's hard. It is difficult. But we need to find opportunities to do it. Because if we don't do that, that person can, over time, especially a child who, and we'll talk about parenting issues and things like this later, but especially a child who is being punished or disciplined frequently, can start to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, well, I have the name, I might as well play the game, this is who I am, this is what people think I am, no one really cares about me, no one really loves me, and they have this what's called fatalistic thinking about themselves. But if that child can have one person in their life, just one, that disciplines them, but it can still tell them that, you know, discipline is because I want you to succeed, and because I can see the potential in you, and because I think you can be a great person, then they can start to question that idea. Then there's a new thought coming into that pattern of thinking. I don't know if that helps. That's okay. Any other questions before we go on? Okay, so we'll do one more, then we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll do the rest. So the next one I want to talk to you about is genuineness. And you might be starting to say, well, a lot of these sound the same. Well, there is a bit of a theme coming here, and they are similar, but there are discrete differences. And, you know, the verse you've got there, and it says, love must be sincere. It must be sincere, otherwise it can be easily perceived and easily detected as to be insincere. And, you know, to be genuine is to be true, to be honest, to be sincere. And this is also one of the things that Carl Rogers came up with. And as we talk more, I think you guys will come to realize that I'm a bit of a fan of Carl Rogers. He has a very soft and very Christian approach to counseling. He came up with it because he could clearly see that if a client doesn't sense that I am genuine, if they sense that I am fake, if they sense that I'm, you know, pretending to have this unconditional positive regard on the outside and on the inside, going, oh, I don't think you're ever going to make it, they will sense it. They will see through it. And it tends to be that the younger a person is, the more easily they can see it and the more easily they can detect it and the further they tend to run from it. He also came up with another thing, which is congruence. And congruence means that the counsellor is authentic and genuine. The counsellor does not present an aloof professional facade, but is present and transparent to the client. There's no air of authority or hidden knowledge, and the client does not have to speculate about what the counsellor really is. So basically, it's what you see is what you get. You know, to be genuine is to be able to express my emotions in a counselling room. So when a person says something that is horrendous, when I have a young man sitting in front of me telling me about how his father sexually molested him when he was 5 and 6 and 7, that I'm allowed to cry. Because if I don't express my emotions, I'm allowed to express disgust and anger. And he can see that, because unless he sees that is my reaction, unless he knows it's sincere, he'd be questioning my humanity. He'd be thinking, well, if you can see here and you can be so professional and you can be so smart about this whole thing and you can be so distant and you can, you know, not connect with me, then obviously there's something missing. It's a bit of humanity not quite there. So it's important for a counsellor to be genuine. It's important for a person who helps another to be honest in their feelings. And the Bible is clear, you know, it compels us to weep with those who weep, to mourn with those who mourn, to laugh with those who laugh. And it means that, again, in my counselling room, when one of my clients comes in and tells me about something that happened during the week, and it's funny, I don't sit there and go, right, okay, yep, I hear, because I'll be like, huh, what's wrong with you? Where is your humanity? Where is your sense of humour? Where is this part of you that I can feel that I'm equal with? Because once I do that, once I put on that professionalism and that, you know, confidence and that distance, then I put on that sense of I'm better than you, I know more than you, and this is all trivial to me. So we'll finish it. Come to your questions. Okay. So fakeness is easily detected in a counselling room. A client who senses that their counsellor is fake and doesn't really care about them will run and will usually never ever return. So from personal experience, and maybe a bit more in my early years of counselling, I can tell you that on days when I wasn't really feeling that great, when I was a little bit sleep deprived, when I really couldn't be bothered and I kind of just dragged myself into my counselling room and I wasn't all there, a lot of those clients didn't come back. Because they could sense my lack of attentiveness. They could sense that I wasn't completely there. They could sense that I was preoccupied with something else. Even though I was attentive as best as I could, I had, you know, good posture, I tried to have eye contact, but it's there, it's in the air, and a person can feel it. And it's important that unless I am in a state and in a place where I can be attentive to someone, where I can listen to someone, sometimes it's better to say, look, I really want to hear this. I really care about this, but I really can't right now. How about we set this time aside? And that person will actually respect me because they'll be able to say, she cares enough to put this time aside and talk about it this time. Most of the time, I know in some cases that's difficult. But in order for me to be genuine in my relationship with others, I also need to be honest about my current state of being. So if I'm in the middle of a family crisis, it would be really difficult for me to counsel a married couple. You know, if my husband and I are at war, then I can't really sit in a counselling room and focus on the couple sitting in front of me. I have to be really honest about what I can and what I can't handle, because the work of a counsellor, the work of a person who has compassionate understanding, requires that I am true to myself and that I am honest about what I can and what I can't do at any given time. You know, I bring up another example into this, and I think of when Lazarus died, you know, and Jesus got there and he saw these people, and in his heart he was sad. I think that they didn't have faith that he could do something about it, and he felt the pain of those weeping around him, and he saw the anguish Mary and Martha were in. He wept. He didn't hold back his tears and pretend or kind of hold back on his emotions. He wept. His emotions were clear and his actions were congruent with them. And that's what congruence is about. That when my actions reflect how I'm feeling, I'm honest in who I am in the relationship. So that's congruence and genuineness. There were two questions over here, and I'm sorry, I just thought we'd finish first. So you were first. You had a question? It's okay, that's not good. Yeah, and yeah, and I am generally honest about it. If someone says something and it is shocking and it is kind of unexpected, I guess a thing to say before that is usually when you've counseled people, when you've walked through a lot of issues with people, after a while you don't get shocked. You know, that's one side of it. And the other side of it is, well, what am I being shocked at? Is it that this person is telling me something really gross that I didn't think I'd hear about their homosexual relationship with another person, for example? Or is this person telling me that they had an affair and I wouldn't have in a million years guessed that this person would do such a thing? I need to address that within myself. Because my reaction, it's not about genuineness here, it's about my judgment. And remember the one before that was that I have this unconditional positive regard. So that's more of a judgment thing, and I need to be very weary and very careful of that. But if someone comes and tells me a funny story or a shocking story, and it is shocking, and they're deliberately meaning it to be, and it's safe, and it's not going to offend them that I feel that way, then I'd be honest about it. I'd say something like, I find that really shocking. You know, I would be honest about my reaction, given that it's not judgment. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Yeah. Yes. But this is different to a confession. A person who tells a counsellor something in a counselling room, a person who comes and shares something with you, is not to get their sin absolved. He's coming to share something with you because he wants to overcome an issue. And like I was saying earlier, the fact that he feels that I'm a human being and we're on equal par means that if there's something that he's deliberate that is shocking to him, then it will be shocking to me. Again, I say, unless it's judgmental, then it's another story altogether. I don't know if that, I hope that helps. We'll talk about that, but there's something important to note. And that is that you don't become on an emotional roller coaster, because one of the things you learn, and we'll talk about this in a minute, is One of the things you learn as a counsellor is that people are resilient. And the person that is sitting in front of you has been through and has lived through a lot more in their life than you could possibly help them through within an hour. It's one thing. And the other thing that you learn is this person is really not your responsibility. As a Christian counsellor, you deal with what you can, you talk through what you can, but your role is to journey with them. Your role is to be an agent of change. Your role is not to dictate the path of their life. My job is not to tell them what to do. So I don't carry their burdens, I don't carry their issues, because I need to help empower them to be able to walk through whatever problems they have. Not take away their problems and stay up all night trying to solve them. That's not my role. And if I do that, I am disempowering them. I am then helping them become dependent on me, which is not something that I want in this relationship. This relationship should be a finite relationship. It has a beginning and an end. A certain point in time will come when that person no longer needs me in their life. And that's what I'm working towards. So I hope that answers. Any other questions before we have a break? Okay, so I think I've been speaking for a while now. So we'll have a break for about 10 minutes. We'll come back, we'll watch a video, we'll do a few things, and then we'll continue. And you can see, from the way he speaks, from his persona, he's a really calm, really gentle, soothing person. Even without him even starting that session, you can sense that, I think, from the way that he speaks. And you can also sense his passion how much he believes it's so important that a counsellor or a therapist needs to have these skills if they're going to be of any value to the client. And I think one of the important things he spoke about as well is that this genuineness, this unconditional positive regard, this compassionate understanding allows a person to go deeper into their emotions, allows a person to speak more about what's happening to them, to start to see things that maybe they hadn't seen before. And next week when we talk about empathy and how we actually start to put this into practice and start to acquire some skills about how we practically do these, you'll start to see that the more you speak to a person in this way, the more you have compassionate understanding for a person, the more they're able to listen to their own emotions, the more they're able to analyze their own emotions, the more that they're able to be more real about what they're going through, and to start to see it in a realistic frame rather than in a fatalistic frame. So what I mean by that is, you know, fatalistic is it's a disaster and it's all over and it's doom and gloom and it's just horrendous, to moving from that to, okay, this is an issue and this is maybe how I can deal with it. And he also talks about how he's hoping to gain a change in her expression, that as she starts to speak, as this client starts to talk about what she's going through, she's going to start to express her emotions more freely and in a different way. She'll be able to gain greater control, is what he's saying, over her emotions over a prolonged period of time. And I think the essence of what he's saying is the whole point of counselling, the whole point of sitting down with someone and walking through a journey with them of pain or suffering, is that that person becomes eventually self-sufficient. And when I say that, I don't mean it in a secular way. I don't mean it in a way that, you know, there is this school of thought in counselling that there's this thing, this positive thinking, where I say I'm good, therefore I'll behave in a good way, etc., etc., etc. And I'm not speaking about it in that way. I'm speaking about it from a Christian point of view. And what I mean by that is self-sufficient in that that person is then able to have a one-to-one relationship with God. They don't need to come to me in order to tell them what the solution of their problem is. They can start to think about the solution. They can start to definitely continue to get advice, continue to get help, continue to get spiritual guidance, but they're no longer dependent upon any one particular person to direct the path of their life. So that, I think, in a nutshell is what he's saying. Does anyone have any questions on the video before we continue along this path? Do you have a question? No, you look like you're going to say something. Okay, anyone have any questions? Any comments on the video? Okay. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I don't think you tell them you don't like them. He comes, let's not forget, from a secular background. Yes, he had a Christian upbringing. upbringing, but at some point in his life he, you know, walked away from that. So he goes with that emotion, that his emotion is the biggest thing that directs him. We're different. You know, for a Christian counsellor, I would take myself aside and I would say, what is it about that person that I don't like? And usually the finger of blame would turn to me. It's usually something about myself that I'm uncomfortable with that makes me uncomfortable with that person. It's not usually something to do with the person as such. So, for example, if I meet, you know, a young person who, you know, thinks they know it all and they don't need my help, and that might really frustrate me, it's usually about my pride and my thinking that I can help them, rather than me thinking that I can journey with them and I can, you know, talk with them and counsel them. And it's really more about me than it is about the person. And I think that's probably a good point, Tiswani, in that that is one of the key differences between a Christian counsellor and a secular counsellor. I was going to mention this at the end, but I think it's probably worthy to mention now, in that one of the biggest differences between a Christian counsellor and a secular counsellor is the world, is a person's worldview. So when I look at a theory, when I look at something that's, you know, been written by someone who's an atheist, or written by someone who denounced Christianity, or written by someone who believes that it is a person is their own God, I critically assess that with a Christianity as my framework, with that as being my lens. So I look at it and I go, well, you know what, this person can't be all bad. There must be something good in what they said, but I'm not going to accept it all. I'm going to take it and filter it through my Bible. I'm going to take it and filter it through my faith. And it was funny because when I was preparing for this lecture series, I thought, well, I wonder if this is true for any other aspects in life. And I came and I found this story. Do you know who the person behind the theory or the fact of gravity is, who actually wrote the theory? Do you know his name? I'm sure the teachers in here would know. Huh? Newton. Okay, good. You guys aren't teachers, right? Yeah, Newton. So Isaac Newton, he was both a mathematician and, shockingly as it may sound, he was also a theologian. He believed that to worship Christ as God is idolatry to him. It was the fundamental sin. So he's this guy who comes up with the formula for gravity, who's saying that worshipping Christ is wrong. Do I then stand up and say, well, I'm a Christian, I'm not going to have anything to do with him, I'm not going to listen to the fact that gravity, this is the theory for gravity, or this is the equation, I'm going to refuse to learn that at school because of this person's faith? Do you guys teach gravity in the Coptic school? Do you teach the formula? Okay, so it's... So I was just wondering... Double checking. You know, his formulae are not in the Bible, but using discretion and using discernment, we're able to establish and distinguish between his ideas about faith that are not so accurate and his scientific theories, which are quite accurate. And the same applies for psychology. You know, there's lots of people out there. Freud was a really confused person who thought it was all sexual. From A to Z, you know, all his stages of development have to do with sexuality. But did you know that Freud came up with this thing called self-defense mechanisms? And I ask you to go away and read about them. And they're so true. They talk about how when a person is attacked, they go into self-defense mode. And a person might start to blame you for the problem. And that's a form of self-defense. They may shout. They may withdraw. They may do a whole host. I believe there are nine of them. Nine distinct self-defense mechanisms. And they're actually quite accurate. So I can look at Freud and go, the guy's nuts, I'm not going to listen to a word he says about anything. Or I can say, hold on, I can use some discretion here. I can be a bit more analytical about this. Yep, he's got some ideas that I don't really agree with, but there's a few things in there that are acceptable and are probably quite right. And I think that's the main difference between a Christian counsellor and a secular counsellor. Is that my worldview, the thing that's at the basis of all my dealings with people, comes from a Christian foundation. So moving from that back to these characteristics of a good counsellor or a person who has compassionate understanding. And the next one you have on your list there is humility and a non-judgmental approach. And so in order for me to be able to journey with another person, I need to come to face with the reality that I don't have all the answers. I need to come to face with that. I need to be able to look myself in the mirror and say, you know what, I don't know it all. I'll never know it all. And that's actually part of this whole process. It's not about me providing the person with an answer. But to effectively counsel another is simply to journey with them, to be an agent of change in their life, not a director of their path. A counselor, a person who comes to you seeking compassion and understanding, is not coming to you, regardless of what they may say, not seeking the answer. I cannot tell you the number of times people come into my office and say, look, just tell us what to do. If you tell me what to do, I'm going to do it. And my response is usually, I really can't do that. Or it's, I wonder how many people in your life have told you what to do. And they'd usually say plenty, or they'd give a number. And my next question would be, well, what's it like for you to hear advice on what to do? And they usually say it's pretty annoying because I already know what I want to do. And then I'm able to say, well, you're not really here because you want me to tell you what to do. I think you're here because you want to work through whatever it is that you already want to do. So when a person comes to you and tells you, tell me what to do, that's not really what they're asking. And if you do, you've fallen into a trap. They usually come back and say, well, I'm not going to do that. That's not for me. I can't do that. That's too hard. That's too easy. I've tried that. And they'll come up with an infinite number of excuses as to why that's not quite the right answer. And the other thing to remember is once a person begins to believe that they are of higher authority than another, then they'll be ineffective in having compassionate understanding in serving another. Once I start to believe that, you know what, I've done this counselling training, I've got my postgraduate degree, I've got this many clients who are better, yep, I know what I'm doing now. I feel confident. You know, every time I've felt that, I've had someone walk through the door that's just completely blown me away with the case. And I'm like, I have no idea, Lord. I really don't know what to do here. I really don't know what to say. This is so shocking. This is so beyond my expectations that it's not something I feel equipped to deal with. And it's almost like, that's actually how you're meant to feel. Because that's when you can be effective in having compassion for another person. And like I said earlier, to not judge a person is not to condone their actions. So when a person comes into my office and says to me, I'm having an affair, and I don't judge that person and I don't look at them and say, oh, you're an evil sinner, you should, you know, go away and do X, Y, and Z. That doesn't mean to say, when I don't do that, that I'm saying to them it's okay to have an affair. I'm not. To not judge is not to condone behaviour. And it's important that we don't get that confused, because people sometimes think, well, if I'm not judging them, then I'm telling them it's okay. No, you're not telling them it's okay. You're not judging them as a person. To be able to deal with another person's raw emotions of, you know, rage, anger, hurt, betrayal, frustration, requires that I'm able to take others' issues to the foot of the cross. If I am able to sit in a room and listen to someone be so angry and be so frustrated and be so hurt and be in so much pain, like someone was asking me earlier, how do I deal with that? Well, I don't. I take it to the foot of the cross. I say, dear Lord, this is your child. They're coming to express your pain to you more than it is to me. It's not for me to carry. I need to know that there are some things, there are some burdens, there are some issues that are not designed for me to carry. My role is not to carry these problems. My role is to simply be non-judgmental and humble in my relationship with this person. And like I said, to do that requires humility, to know that a person who journeys... to know that it is the person who journeys to health and improvement, not the counsellor. It's actually the person that does the work. When a person comes and sits down with a counsellor or with any other person to get help to improve in their life, it's not that that person is going to go out and do the hard work for them. They're actually going to do it themselves. So when a person sits there and talks to me about pain of abuse and how difficult it is for them to remember it, it might be very painful for me to hear, but it's nowhere near as painful as it is for them to actually live and experience and work through it. And, you know, going back to that example of Jesus with the woman caught in adultery, even though he had that full authority to judge, he didn't. He indirectly kept saying to people, I don't like your behaviour. I don't accept your sin. I don't want you to sin. I want you to sin no more, but I love you. as a person. I don't like the behavior, but I love you as a person. And it's almost like as a counselor, I need to keep that always in the back of my mind. To be effective in having compassion for another person is always to try to think in that framework. And a non-judgmental approach gives the person permission and safety to say whatever it is that they want to say, including things that they can't say to another person because they'd be so afraid of being judged. And again, I say that's why people say things in a counselling room that they probably wouldn't say anywhere else, because they know that there is a sense of safety. Other than the confidentiality and the fact that they know it goes nowhere, there's this sense that no matter what I say, I've come to a point in this relationship where I believe she's not going to judge me. He's not going to look down on me. So if one is to gain the trust of another person, then they must first need to prove themselves as non-judgmental. Because people will continuously test and continuously come in and question, and people will say things. If you start a relationship where you are helping another person, they'll say things deliberately to shock you. They'll say things deliberately to provoke you, to annoy you. And that's why I think a lot of people in this room who've worked with young people, you know, teenagers, will find that they can frustrate you in Sunday school for 3 years, and then suddenly you start to have a relationship with them. It's like, what, now I've passed the test? And it's like, yes, now you've passed the test. Now they have this firm belief that you're going to like me no matter what. You love me unconditionally, so I can be open, so I can be honest. I can tell you these secrets that I wouldn't tell my parents. I can tell you about the things, the questions, the worries that I have that I wouldn't dare ask anyone else. Because now you've passed that test. You've passed that test of non-judgment. You've passed that test of trust. Any questions on that one?
To be non-judgmental, you've got to be like, you know, like a good Christian, someone who's very repentant and, you know, working on their spiritual life constantly and things like that. So that seems to be very difficult. It's not a switch that you'll switch on and say, yep, I'm not going to judge the person. So if someone comes to you with a problem, you just, you know, direct them to someone else because you have that fear that you're not up to scratch with your spirituality.
I think once a person feels like they're up to scratch in their spirituality is when they'll be judgmental. I think knowing that I'm not up to scratch and knowing that I'll never be up to scratch in my spirituality plays a role in not being judgmental. Now, I can't really judge this person while I'm not 100% in my life. And no one is 100%. And that's the thing. I think that's the thing to grasp, in that this non-judgmental approach comes from the belief that, you know, no one is perfect. Everyone has faults. So the minute I start to think, well, I need to be a bit more spiritual, once I get to a certain spiritual level, that's when I can stop judging people, then what I'm effectively saying is, you know, people at this spiritual level, when will I know that I'm at that particular spiritual level? And if I feel like I'm at that particular spiritual level, that I'm a bit above, then presto, I'm being judgmental. You know? And I'm not trying to say that to out with you, but what I'm trying to say is, you're right, it does require a spiritual path, it does require a spiritual relationship, it does require a spiritual life, but I'm not a saint. I'm not standing here telling you guys I'm this perfect saint who has all these characteristics. I'm saying to you that at least for the hour that a counselor is with someone, at least for that hour alone, I can try to put aside everything else. And I can try to focus really hard and see this person as a human being equal to me. And the reason that a counsellor has a limited time with a person and probably has limited sessions in a week or in a day is because you humanly can only do that for so long. It's quite an exhausting exercise to be sitting there fully attentive, not being judgmental, being completely present and doing a whole host of other things which we'll talk about in the coming weeks. And that's why I wouldn't encourage you guys to go out there and find 30 people that need help and start working. I'd rather encourage you is to adopt one person and try to develop that non-judgmental, that unconditional positive regard with that one person. Practice it on that one person and do it for a limited period of time over a long period of time. And then you'll start to see that, yes, you're right, this isn't something I can't say to you that every counsellor walks around and has absolutely no judgment for anyone in the street and doesn't see parents that are doing bad things and think, how dare you do such a thing, what a terrible parent you are. They do, they're human beings, they're not above anyone. But for that hour, for that period of time, I'm with someone, I do the very best that I can, I do my utmost to focus and be in a place where I can acquire or I can at least think of a person in all these ways. So I hope that helps. Please. Yeah, Tasoni's right. It is very much a learned skill, and it's an acquired skill. It's a skill that you gain over a period of time, and the more you look into this stuff and the more you start to think about things like empathy and understanding and how a person thinks and personality types, the more you start to gain a greater understanding for people in general, and you start to then see that person not just as the person that's sitting before you, but you, because they expose about themselves, because they talk to you about their life, you start to see that person as an accumulation of their past to this point. So when a teenager is sitting there and they're angry and they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just so frustrating to you and you're so annoyed by them, you stop seeing them that way and you start to see this person as a net result of how they have been treated, of the circumstances that they possibly live in at home, of the yellings and the abuse that they might have suffered in their life. I'm not saying that excuses the behaviour because you eventually want to help them change that behaviour, but you can see the root cause of that behaviour. You can see where it stems from. And then you're able to look at that person holistically as a whole rather than just the behaviour that's being exhibited in front of you.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit of a off-topic sort of question, but you said that like counselling, that it's a small amount of time and that there's only so much they can do in a day.
Yeah.
Okay, now I guess what we know is our church fathers here, a lot of their time is spent doing counselling. So I guess like all counsellors, should they first have that, you know, like that education sort of thing and limit themselves to the amount of counselling that they do in a day? Like,
there aren't any priests here, so I can't answer that. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get into that discussion because it's something a bit beyond the scope of this. What a priest should and shouldn't do is something I think for them to decide. And there's none of them here, so I'm not going to speak on their behalf. Sorry, I'm going to avoid that one. One-on-one maybe we could talk about. So the next quality I want to talk about is in order for a counsellor to be an effective counsellor, they need to be a good listener. And that might seem really obvious, you know. A person who's sitting there listening to people day in, day out needs to be a good listener. But some of the characteristics of a good listener are not always so obvious. And having all the characteristics we spoke about is fantastic, but they don't necessarily mean that a person is a good listener. I can be non-judgmental. I can have unconditional positive regard. I can be congruent in how I feel. I can even have the, you know, compassionate understanding. But when someone says something, I just want to say my opinion. I just want to finish their sentences. I just want to tell them what I really think. I want to share a story with them. And a lot of it's about me. So there are some other characteristics that are required for a person to be a good listener. And one of them has a lot to do with empathy. A good listener is a person who can put themselves in another person's place, where I can walk in your shoes for an hour and start to see what life is like from your eyes and start to feel your emotions. Then I'm starting on becoming a good listener. When a person is truly attentive to another, they treat them as if they're the only person in the world. I've spoken to people like this in my life, and they still amaze me. And they usually are people who are very, very successful. They're people who you can walk into a crowded room, and if they're having a conversation with you, they see no one else. You are the center of their attention, and they're completely focused and completely attentive with you. I'm not one of those persons outside the counseling room. I'm easily distracted. But a person who is a good listener, generally, not just as a counsellor, tends to do that, tends to treat the person that they're speaking to as if they are the only person in the world for that moment that they're speaking to them. And what happens is that person that they're speaking to feels cherished, feels held, feels valued. Some people get a little bit uncomfortable when they get that kind of attention, and other people start to think, oh, am I that important that this person really just disregards everyone else and just is speaking to me? And it automatically starts a person thinking internally about themselves. So to be a good listener is to have the capacity to do that. And that is also something that comes with practice. A good listener is a person who's able to hear unsaid statements, and it's one of the things we're definitely going to talk about in empathy. But to give you a highlight, you know, when someone sits in front of you and says, I'm so annoyed, a good listener can hear that behind that annoyance, below the surface, what that person's actually saying maybe is, I'm so hurt, I'm in pain, something's happened that saddened me. And so a good listener is a person that can hear an unsaid statement, an implied comment. And a good listener is a person who's comfortable with emotions. A lot of people get very uncomfortable around emotions because they feel they have to do something to fix it. And again, we'll talk a lot more about emotions in our emotions week. But, you know, when a person cries, for example, there is this tendency that I need to do something. There are so many times when I'd be counselling couples when a woman would start to get emotional and cry, for example, and this couple may have been married for 10, 20 years, and he'd try to change the subject and make it light and happy and talk about something positive, even though we may be progressing and we may be getting to the core issue of what's happening between them, because he doesn't want her to be sad and he wants to fix it. He wants to fix her emotion. Being sad is such a negative thing to him. So he'll get some tissues and he'll try to make a joke and he'll be like, oh, darling, it's okay, it's all right. And what he's actually doing is he's saying, I'm really uncomfortable with my own emotions. So I'm not very comfortable in seeing other people's emotions, and partly because I'm a man, I have this tendency to want to fix it. So the thing that I'm going to do is to try to just skip over this one. Let's just skip the crying bit. Let's just get to the serious is okay. Funny is fine, but sad, you know, crying, pain, hurt, I don't know how to deal with that. I can't be a good listener if I'm not able to hear and be present in people's emotions. And it's interesting, you know, in the story of the woman who washed and anointed Christ's feet, she walked into a crowded house, and from memory, I think I read the story recently, I don't think she said a word. I don't think she really spoke at the beginning. She went to his feet and started to cry and clean them and wash them and anoint them, but he heard the cry of her heart. He ignored what people were saying outwardly, and he would actually connect with her and hear the emotion that she was feeling and hear a lot of the unsaid things. Now, I know we don't all have the gift of being able to hear another person's innermost cries and innermost thoughts, but we can learn to be attentive to them. We can learn to be available to them. So when they happen, when we sense that maybe we might be sensing what this person might be feeling, we can start to express it to them and start to tell them, well, I wonder if what's happening here is that you're actually really sad about this. And, you know, sometimes they'll say, no, that's not the case. And sometimes they'll say, yes, that's it, that's how I feel. And with time, we'll start to learn how the physical and the outward clues give rise to what's happening underneath, what's happening below the surface. And the other thing about a really good listener, which you may not be aware of, is to be actually comfortable to sit with another person in silence. And that is something that most people find so difficult. But a lot of times in a counselling room, When someone has started to speak about something that's really deep or really profound or really major in their life, sometimes it takes them away and it shocks them that they've even said it, that they need time to just sit in silence and reflect and calm down in order to be able to think and continue and talk about what they're saying. So to be able to sit in that silence and not be uncomfortable and not be squirming in my chair and not be, you know, okay, so what do we say next and what do we do? But just to give that person the freedom to be themselves and the freedom to be reflective in your presence is actually one of the most empowering gifts we can give to that person. And finally, a good listener isn't afraid to admit when they don't always understand. You know, they're not afraid to say, I can't comprehend what this would have been like. It's beyond me to even think how painful that situation was for you. To be honest about my inability to imagine or to empathize with someone is far better than for me to sit there and go, yeah, I totally understand when I have no idea. Because they'll see right through that. So they are some of the characteristics of a good listener. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
One case you might not think it's such a big deal or something like that. Basically, you don't really understand where they're coming from. How then can you empathize with them?
So if I don't understand where they're coming, like if they're saying something and to them it's catastrophic and it's life impacting and I see it as a trivial thing, aren't I being a bit judgmental? Because isn't how they see it and how they perceive it and how it impacts them is very much determined by their personality and by what they've been through in their life. For example, you can have two people, right? One person can have a premature child and another can have a premature child. One person can say, wow, this is fantastic, this is a gift from God, this child is okay, they're alive, they're a bit early, but they're going to be fine, I know they're going to survive, it's completely okay, and life will go on and it's all right. And they can be really positive and they can be really grateful that the child made it to 34, 35, whatever weeks. Right? You can have another person with a child in the same place, sitting in the next incubator in that NIC unit, right, or the child intensive care unit, and they can be thinking, why did God do this to me? What a horrible thing. How could this happen to me? Why is life so painful? Why is it that I always have to have problems? Why did he give me a sick child? Why is it that I don't think I can cope? I don't think I can handle the stress. Two people, identical situation, very different outlook. If person B told person A that that's how she was seeing things, person A might think, well, that's a bit silly. Your child is alive and healthy and well and will probably be okay. You know, it's 2010 or 2011 or whatever the case may be. You know, modern science and medicine, you'll be fine. What's the problem? Whereas person B would be thinking, well, this is another burden I don't feel like I can carry. To say one is right and one is wrong, to say that it's right to think this way and it's wrong to think that way and that person shouldn't think that way, it's being judgmental because I don't know what path that person has taken in their life to get to the point where they feel like this is such a burden and this is such a major problem. And the other person might have had an easier road. You know? I don't know. Does that answer your question? Any other questions? Yeah.
Is your role as a listener to comfort them or to just let them cry?
It depends on the situation, right? There's no cold, hard and fast rules about how to behave or what to say. It really, really depends on the situation. You know, if a person is crying hysterically and they're out of control, you want to calm them down and bring them to a place where they can talk and they can start to get in touch with their feelings and what's happening and why it is that they got to that point. But if a person is talking about grief, for example, and a person for the first time in their life has been given permission to cry about a death of a loved one, for example, then who am I to say to them, you need to stop crying? You know, it's not my place. What would be respectful, what would be right of me to do is to give them that space, to give them that opportunity, to provide them with that safety that they can do that knowing that they're not going to be judged and that there's not going to be a time when I go, okay, that's it, enough grieving now, enough crying, you've got to stop, we've got to move on, other things to talk about. Because that would be inhumane, to say the least. Any other questions?
Okay, you've kind of answered it, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. How do you respect emotions? Like, sometimes I think with difference in gender and some, like, you know, how they're made, you kind of think that emotions aren't going to, they're not going to benefit. Like, there's no point in having, you know, a negative, or if you're upset about something, it's not going to solve the problem. And you kind of, yeah, I think it's a form of disrespect to that person, but it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And logically. I think, yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's when emotions don't make sense to you, or you think that they're not in line with what's happening, or maybe greater than what would be expected in that situation. You know, someone breaks a glass and they're crying hysterically, for example. You want to say, calm down, it's not such a big deal. And I think when we talk about emotions, and we'll talk about emotions in great depth, what you'll come to realize is emotion is information. Our emotions are keys to what's happening within us. So when a person is highly emotional about something, it's not you, especially when it's something trivial, for use of a better word, it's not usually that thing that they're emotional, that they're very, very sad about. That thing is usually symbolic of a lot of other things. So for the person who breaks a glass and cries hysterically, a lot of the times it's because that person possibly has been told that they are clumsy, that they never handle things well, that they can't look after anything, that people give them things and they destroy them, messages that they might have received as a child, but have somehow come into their memory, have come into this place at this time and have meant that they react to certain things in a much more heightened way than another person would have. So once again we learn a bit more about emotion, you'll start to realize that emotions are not, in and of themselves, may not mean much, but when you look at a person's whole picture and their whole life, they provide a lot of information and are keys to a lot of other aspects of a person's life.
Is a benchmark upon anything?
No. No.
Because someone could do something really bad and not really mind.
Yeah.
And,
no, you know, there's no. There's
how
no,
do you know what's overreacting? And what's
there's no benchmark, because there's no benchmark to humanity as far in terms of human reaction to things. It's not. There's no standard by which we say, well, this is, you know. But there are people who are obviously neurotic and who have mental health issues. But like we said at the beginning, this isn't the people that we are talking about or that we would be dealing with. We're talking about average people who have issues and not.
Just I got a couple more.
A couple more. It's all right, I've allowed for a few minutes for questions.
How do you convert? Because you know you said people can see through you, right? You've got to be genuine because they can tell through your actions. So how can you turn a thought into being genuine? Because you can sit there and think to yourself, yeah, I'm not going to judge this, but this person's fine. It's not his fault. It's his actions, blah, blah. I'm not going to, you know, judge him. But realistically speaking, what you think... Very commonly, yeah, your actions, you know, are in conflict.
Yeah, and
no, they're opposite.
Oh, so what yeah.
You're thinking because
oh, okay.
It's just
if you're thinking,
mental
thing. Yeah, and like I said at the very beginning, I need to be very aware of my shortcomings. I need to be very aware of what I am and am not capable of doing. And if I find myself in that place where I am internally judging a situation or a person or thinking this isn't quite right, then I might stop the session. I might say, look, I'm having difficulty really understanding this. Can you tell me a bit more? I'd give myself space and time and explanation to explore the issue a little bit more. But can we give someone else a chance to ask questions and then come back if we have time? Is there anyone else that's got any other questions? There was someone at the back, sorry. Yeah.
Humanity things. Humility in order to be compassionate. And if you're coming from this perspective, you will be generally compassionate. However, in some cases, if someone has borderline personality disorder, for example, and they catastrophizing or they seeking attention all the time, we have to acknowledge that this is an issue that I'm not trained or capable of dealing with.
Yeah.
And this is where I sort of stop. You can't just be sort of, you can be there, you can empathize, you can sort of be non-judgmental, you can care, whatever you can provide.
Yeah.
But in order to do something over your capabilities, that could actually put you at risk, if you know where I'm coming from.
And that's why very early on I was saying that we are talking about dealing with common, everyday people who have issues. I'm not talking about people who have mental health issues.
Exactly.
And even having said that, as a counsellor who's been trained for a few years and who's been working for quite a few years, if there is a case that comes before me where I know it is above and beyond what I'm capable of handling, then I have an obligation, I have a duty to refer that case to someone else. And I do that very frequently. And I must do that because one of the counsellor's primary responsibilities is not to cause harm. If a person comes to see a counsellor and they have this trust and this openness and they're willing to expose their soul, they're very vulnerable. And they're very vulnerable to being hurt. So unless I can be honest and say, look, this is actually a little bit above and beyond what I can do, it needs to go to someone else. Unless I have the ability to do that, I shouldn't be counselling someone. I need to have that humility and that really clear understanding of what I am and what I'm not capable of. Let's not kid ourselves. Because, yes, you can cause harm.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also very good buoyant for your own self-reflection too, in terms of where you are at, what are your values and what I can actually accept and be this non-judgmental and what is actually I can't. Well, you have to be very honest with yourself because it's going to be very transparent to the clients and that's been seen, and that is the harm that you've referred to.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Was there another question anyway? We've got time for maybe one or two quick ones. There's one over here. Sorry, guys. I'll come to you guys. Just get this one.
A person who are very, very sensitive and very emotional and sentimental, and you have no idea, can be a suitable or a good counselor, because I think I get very emotional with the people. Very, very emotional. And maybe I cry before they start.
Okay, so... Let me just say something so we're all clear on the same page. Maybe I didn't make this clear. This lecture series is not designed so that you walk out of here counsellors. It takes a couple of years of pretty demanding study to do that. I'm not equipped to even teach it, right? But what this lecture series aims to do is to give you some skills so that with the people that you're already serving or those who you may encounter in the future, you have more tools in your toolkit that you can use and more ideas and a different perspective on maybe how to see them that maybe you've had or maybe you haven't had before. But it's not... This lecture series isn't designed for you to go out and to be a counsellor. I just want to make that... So when you say you are emotional and you are a sensitive soul, that can be a very... positive characteristic to have when someone needs a soft place to land, when someone needs someone to cry with them, when someone needs someone to be gentle with them. So that doesn't mean to say that you can't help people, you can't have compassionate understanding for people because you're a sensitive person. So I think it can be an asset.
I feel that I don't relate them. I feel that I am encouraging them more.
And I think hopefully through some of the skills that we talk about, that won't be the case. I'll get this question and then we'll wrap up.
I don't know how this question is going to start, but I'm hoping that I'll express it the right way. Like, sometimes I think that I become so naive. Like, I believe anything that the person says, especially if they've sat or they're victims.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, how do I learn? Like, I know that you, like... You probably might not have the answer, but your advice. Like, how do I draw the line of not accepting everything that they say and take it as truth?
Okay. I think there's two things to realize in a counseling room, that person's truth is truth for them. So when I'm counseling someone with a person-centered approach, it's what they believe is true for them. But having said that, one of the hidden goals of counseling is to help this person achieve a more realistic view of the world. So what I'd be constantly doing is questioning their think, and we'll talk about this in greater length, questioning their thought process and questioning their emotions, not so that they provide me an answer, but so that they question it themselves. And as I do that, through the process of continuously helping them analyze and question and rephrase and relook at things in different ways, they start to see things in a more moderate way. They start to see things in a more realistic way. And as they do that, I do that. But the point is, I can't be swayed by what they're saying. My role is to be an agent of change, and my role is simply to walk the path with them, not to agree and get caught up in their emotion along the way, because then I'm useless to them. Okay, so we'll leave it there. Thank you all for coming. We might just say Our Father before we leave, since we're in church. And I'll hopefully see you all next Thursday night at 7:30, and we'll try our best to start on time next week. So.